Des Moines has seen a spike in the number of homicides. This hour, what's behind the alarming numbers? It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our handful of short conversations today concludes our week-long series examining guns and gun culture. Also this hour, concerns, especially among Black Iowans, about Iowa's new Stand Your Ground law, why more research is needed about threat detection, how gun culture here in the U.S. is a completely different caliber when compared to other advanced Western democracies, and how the gun debate is presented in the media. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A special focus this Friday News Buzz on our handful of quick conversations, capping off our week-long series examining guns and gun culture. Well, the Des Moines area is on track to possibly set an unenviable record for that city in the number of homicides in 1 year. Paul Parizik joins us, sergeant and a public information officer with the Des Moines Police Department. Sergeant Parizik, welcome back to our program.
Hey, thank you.
How many homicides so far in 2017?
Right now we're at 21. And in 2015, that was the mark we hit for the whole year. And that was the highest number we've had since 1995. So with the amount of time remaining in the year, there's a very real possibility that we'll exceed that 21 that we hit in 2015.
Mm-hmm. What would be, it's hard to say it this way, a typical year?
Well, you know, when I went back and looked over about 15 years worth of data, you know, we've had as low as 5 in a year. And then obviously up to 21, we seem to hover right around the 7, 8, 9 range.
Mm-hmm. And for the Des Moines area, which has just over 500,000 residents, is this sort of homicide rate typical for a city that size?
When you compare it nationally, there's things that are hard to do when it comes to comparing those rates. Like the challenge is you have to look at each city and the issues in those cities and the culture within those cities to determine whether or not, you know, you can compare yourself to a Little Rock, Arkansas, or a Lincoln, Nebraska. There's a lot of different things there. Mm-hmm. So we don't think we stand out horribly, but obviously the number is something that we're not happy with, and it's definitely something that's kind of alarming to us, and we're looking at different options that we have available to us to get that number turned around.
Okay, we'll talk about those options in a minute, but first, how do you explain it, this dramatic rise in homicides?
It's difficult to explain. We've had this conversation a lot about whether or not it's got something to do with the number of handguns or just firearms in general that are on the streets since our right to carry laws changed. Youth violence. There's so many different factors involved that we have to look at each one of these homicides on its own contributing factors and then try and figure out where we're going to go from there. A big piece of it here in Des Moines is youth violence right now, and our youth outreach programs are full. We've expanded the programs that we have. They fill up constantly. So we're trying to do that part on our end. But we always say, you know, this whole thing starts at home.
Mm-hmm. So when you say youth, we've got to focus on the youth. So we're talking about gang violence and drugs here with the youth.
Well, those two don't necessarily always connect with what we're seeing right now. In 1995, when we had 21 homicides, we had a lot of gang activity in the city of Des Moines. It was very organized gang activity, and the idea or the thrust behind it was the distribution of narcotics. What we're seeing now is we have gang activity in Des Moines. We have a lot of gang members that are committing violent crimes, but they're very disorganized, and it makes it a little more of a challenge to address some of their issues, because it's not about narcotics distribution. It's about these emotionally driven decisions that these kids are making, and we know kids don't always think through their actions. These guys just happen to have guns or in their hands or access to firearms, and it ends up in something much more serious than it ended up when we were kids.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us, is one factor, do you think, that there's easier access to guns for the youth?
Well, it seems to be that there's a lot more guns out there in the wrong hands. Now, when we look at some of the numbers that we've come up with to compare to last year, I looked at the number of guns that we have seized as evidence in crimes. We've seized 122 so far this year. Same period last year, we seized 172, but we didn't have nearly as many shootings. So I don't necessarily know if it's necessarily the access to firearms, but it's the behaviors or the comfort that people have when they do have access to firearms and using them. The problem with kids is they don't think beyond the end of that gun when they pull the trigger, and they don't really necessarily think about the consequences. So I think the bad combination is guns in young hands.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about kids, and we're adults here. But how old are we actually talking when we say kids?
Oh, we're talking that 16 to 18, 19-year-old range. Some of them, are a little older, but we're talking about our kids that should be in high school, and focusing on sports and their friends and their studies, and we just don't have, we don't have that stability in a lot of these homes right now that guides the kids in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me the story of one killing this year in that you would say is typical or representative of what you're seeing?
It would be probably 18, 19-year-old kid arguing with some other 18, 19-year-old kid about something that is really not a significant issue. Maybe a small amount of marijuana, maybe a girl, and maybe some dispute over some perceived disrespect, and the thing will escalate to the point where it should go to a fist fight, but somebody pulls out a gun and shoots the other guy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That would be it.
So let's talk about the options you have. You talked about that earlier. How are you and the rest of the Des Moines police force reacting to this high number of homicides? Doing anything differently?
No, like I said, we've expanded a lot of our youth programs. One thing that we've done for many, many years that we're trying to really reinforce and grow within the community is the connection that we have with our community leaders, the faith-based leaders that we have, and Will Keeps is a guy that's done tremendous work for the police department, reaching out to the kids through his music. So we're trying to find some creative ways where we can connect with people that we maybe didn't connect with before really well.
Mm-hmm.
So those are a lot of the things that we're doing.
Earlier this week, I spoke with a trauma surgeon at Mercy Medical Center there in Des Moines. Mercy has the busiest ER in the state. Dr. Denville Myrie, perhaps you know him. He was relaying some very distressing statistics. 5 years ago, in their hospital, zero gunshot deaths occurring, gunshot deaths brought there and eventually dying at the hospital. And now this year and last year, many deaths related to guns. And I asked him because I knew in his background he had done work also in Baltimore, which we very much connect with gun violence. And I asked him if Des Moines was becoming more like Baltimore. And he said very definitely that was surprising.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would make that connection. Two different cities, two different, climates. I think when we see a rise or a sudden rise, it catches our eye because it is the outlier. It's something that we're not used to seeing. So the problem, it looks sometimes a lot more imposing than it actually is. Now, we don't want anybody dying in our city, obviously. But I wouldn't go so far as to compare us to a Baltimore. And the reason I would say that is just outsider looking in, it doesn't look all the time like the public safety community in Baltimore is connected with the community. We have that connection. We've got the open lines of communication, and we've got people working together to solve the problem. I think what he's seen in the hospital is definitely the same thing we're seeing. When we look at the number of investigations we've started compared to this time last year, where we can confirm that there was actually a shooting incident, whether it's property damage or personal injury, it's only up five.
Mm-hmm.
There's so
Okay. So talk a little bit more before we end this conversation about the new laws you mentioned at the outset of this conversation: conceal carry, stand your ground. Do you see those having an impact on the climate there, the way your officers have to operate? Any impact in law enforcement that you can detect so far?
Well, you know, we typically try and stay out of the political side of things because, you know, we're here to enforce the law. You know, we definitely support responsible gun ownership. That's what the law says can happen. We responsible gun owners aren't necessarily a concern of ours. The stand your ground law, it's something that definitely caught our attention. And the piece of it that kind of becomes concerning to me is that it's written in there that you can be wrong of in your estimation of the threat against you and still be justified in the use of force. That kind of takes away our ability to have that oversight of dangerous behaviors and determine whether or not they're criminal or not.
Right. Because just to reiterate what you said, I can go out and perceive a threat. Actually, there is no threat, but it's my perception that counts in this law, right?
Yeah. And yes.
As a reasonable person.
As a reasonable person, yeah. Now, the margin, you know, for determining what's reasonable, that's something that will be debated, I'm sure. But we can very easily see people being killed this year and absolutely no consequence to that, where last year somebody might have been criminally charged. And, you know, the laws on the books to defend yourself in the state of Iowa, I believe they were sufficient. If you were threatened with bodily harm or the potential for death, you had the right to defend yourself up to and including, you know, killing another person if you have to.
Mm-hmm. Does, you know, Sergeant Parizic, does the new Stand Your Ground law, your concerns about it, does that change the way your officers react or investigate a shooting because of the judgment, the perception idea that you just mentioned?
That would all depend on whether or not that comes up in the investigation. If our detectives are investigating a shooting, or, I mean, this doesn't just apply to handguns. If somebody hit somebody with a baseball bat defending themselves, the stand your ground law would apply also. But if our detectives were investigating a crime and the person who had to kill someone else explained that they were fearful that they were going to be seriously injured or killed or somebody else near them was, that's definitely something we have to consider. Even if we thought, hey, you know, that doesn't really look threatening to us, and not as just a police officer. That doesn't look threatening to me as Paul Parizic. But you said you were threatened. You felt threatened. You know, we have to take that into consideration. Now, tough decisions for the county attorney's office to make as we move forward. I mean, they ultimately have the charging decision.
Okay. Thank you for giving us your view on this. Sergeant Paul Parizic, a public information officer with the Des Moines Police Department. Thank you for your time, sir.
Hey, you bet. Take care.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the usual quick Friday conversations, but with a special focus on news related to guns to conclude our week-long examination of guns and gun culture here on River to River. Stand your ground. That's a provision we've heard a lot about in the new Iowa law, the overhaul of Iowa's gun laws. I'm joined now by IPR's Katarina Sestarik, who's been reporting on some concerns that some non-white Iowans are having about the law as it's being implemented. Remind us about this Stand Your Ground provision. What changes?
Well, what changes is Iowans and people in general always had the right to self-defense. What this changes is people don't have the duty to retreat anymore. So you can use deadly force even if there's a way for you to escape a situation if you feel that your life is threatened or you feel that you might be seriously injured or robbed, something like that.
Okay, so it may not turn out to be an actual threat, but if in that moment, later in a courtroom, someone says a reasonable person could think that was a threat, you would be right, even though there perhaps wasn't a threat.
Right. And so under Iowa's new law, then you would technically be immune from criminal and civil prosecution.
Okay. So you looked in your reporting about some concerns that non-white Iowans are having. What turned you on to this aspect?
You know, during the debate in the legislature, you heard from a lot of Black Iowans, from Representative Ross Smith, from Waterloo, arguing against the Stand Your Ground law and how it could disproportionately affect Black people, people of color. And after the law was passed, you didn't really hear from them anymore. And I was just left wondering, what are they doing? You know, are they educating people about this? Are they worried? What's going on with the opponents of this law?
Mm-hmm.
So I started with Representative Ross Smith. People might remember him because he wore a hoodie when he was speaking against the law in the legislature. And he introduced me to some other people in Waterloo as well. So in talking to them, basically, they saw a lot of fear among some Black Iowans when the law was first passed because of things that have happened in other states with Stand Your Ground laws.
So one of the people that you spoke with, interestingly, was a pastor in Waterloo who organized a town hall meeting after a mother came to her with concerns about this new law.
Yes, Belinda Creighton Smith. She's a pastor in Waterloo, and she teaches at the University of Northern Iowa. And here's what she said about conversations she has with young African-American men and how those sort of change with the new Stand Your Ground law.
Historically, we've had to educate our sons. We've had to tell them, turn the music down, sit straight in the car, have both hands on the steering wheel. You know what I'm saying? We've had to tell them to make sure that you're aware of your surroundings. Do not be demonstrative in, when you express yourselves, because people may misunderstand that. What I'm telling young people now is that if you're at Walmart and you're in the parking lot, make sure that you're in the parking lot alone. I mean, don't be too close behind someone who's walking to their car and their car just happened to be near your car, because they may feel that you're a threat and that you're following them.
Mm. And this pastor, Belinda Creighton Smith, is saying this is specific to non-white Iowans. Iowans wouldn't have to take these extra precautions?
Right. And, you know, she says it's not fair that people of color have to deal with this kind of thing, with being that careful. But to her, it's worth it if it saves a life.
Katarina, in your reporting, you cited a 2015 study by the American Bar Association that found states with Stand Your Ground laws experienced an increase in homicides, and that the application of the laws results in racial disparities. So this is perhaps a look into Iowa's future.
Right. So they looked at data and different studies from all across the country, and what it showed was that a Stand Your Ground law was linked to increase in homicides in the states that passed those laws. And when there are white-on-black shootings, those are found justified in courtrooms at a much higher rate than a black-on-white shooting. Also, in Florida, where the first Stand Your Ground law was passed in 2005, they found that when the victim is black, those shootings are found justified much more often, regardless of the race of the shooter. So this could be, you know, black people shooting black people, white people shooting black people. But in both of those cases, the victim is black and it's more common to be found justified.
Mm. Okay. Thank you very much. Katarina Sestarek, Iowa Public Radio, Eastern Iowa reporter. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This News Buzz focusing on guns and gun culture to cap off our week-long series examining that. Well, threats headlining our news today from Spain. Detecting potential threats is part of the job for police officers, also for military personnel and security guards. Researchers at Iowa State University have found, however, that the likelihood of an officer detecting a threat is, well, it's a little better than flipping a coin. Don Sweet is with us, professor of communication studies and psychology at Iowa State University. Don, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
Let's talk about this new research that you have done, teaming up with professor of psychology, Christian Meissner, published in the journal Law and Human Behavior. What did you look at?
So we were interested in whether or not people could actually discriminate those who are concealing a weapon, a gun, for example, or an unstable device from those people who are not concealing those objects.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find?
across three studies, what we found was there was no significant differences in the performance of law enforcement officers and naive controls. So that's to say that across three experiments, when tasked with identifying who might be concealing a weapon or a dangerous device, there was no difference in performance between law enforcement officers and naive controls.
Okay, just every day, you or me, because we're not in law enforcement. In other words, we're naive controls. We could be.
Yes.
Anyway, right. Okay, so when the weapon is concealed, we're looking at, for cues, we're looking at behavior. So that's all we have to go on to detect a threat in this case, right?
Yes, that's correct. So we have one chance out in the real world to identify who might be concealing an object. And that's a very, very difficult task. So what this research is not doing, it is not saying that police officers are bad at their jobs. What this research is showing that this is a line of inquiry that needs to be developed and studied further so that we could give law enforcement officers the tools they need to keep not only themselves safe, but to keep us, members of the public, safe
and
from these types of threats.
Important research here, because I understand that currently, we don't do a very good job of threat detection.
You're right, we don't. And again, it's because we don't have the systematic research to support the training that law enforcement and members of the military are receiving.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what is the overhaul, and it sounds like an overhaul that you're talking about here, that we need to get more scientific data here to help in the training process for our law enforcement?
Right. What I would like to see as a researcher is backing away from some of these technological solutions that have been offered. So, for example, in a recent Government Accountability Office report, they found that all the efforts that the TSA are performing at airports, none of that is reliable. So what we need to do is back off that technology and say, okay, what is it about the behavior? So we need to support social science research. Specifically, we need to support research that investigates what specific body-based behaviors might help an officer discriminate between someone who is concealing a weapon and someone who is not. And we need to identify the reliable indicators, and that's going to be achieved through more systematic research.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very quickly before we say goodbye, you're saying looking at the behavior is the psychology, the behavior of a potential threat, a person, is going to be more reliable than using all these very expensive, fancy machines.
The research looking at the nonverbal behaviors could ultimately support the technology, but right now we don't know enough about which behaviors are the reliable indicators, and that's where we need to start.
Don, we're hearing more about terrorist attacks in Europe, in Spain, a van in this case used as a weapon. With your research in mind, do you have any thoughts on threat detection when vehicles are used as weapons?
That's not my area of expertise, but I do believe there are people who are doing research into what motor vehicles look like when they're carrying a heavy payload.
Dawn Sweet is a professor of communication studies and psychology at Iowa State University, talking about her new research with Christian Meissner, published in the journal Law and Human Behavior, talking about the likelihood of a police officer identifying someone concealing a gun or bomb. It's only slightly better than chance. Dawn Sweet, thanks.
Thank you.
Short break. We'll be back with more of this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, capping off our week-long series examining guns and gun culture. When we do come back, we'll talk about how gun laws, attitudes, views here in the United States are a completely different caliber when we compare them to the views, the attitudes, and laws in other advanced Western democracies. Also, how the gun debate is presented in the media. That's when we return. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay with us. And we're back midstream in this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. NewsBuzz, of course, a handful of quick conversations to end the week. Today with a slightly different twist because we're ending our week-long series examining guns and gun culture. We are then focusing on a number of issues through these short conversations to do with that topic. Of course, gun ownership is not a unique thing to American culture. America's peers, other advanced Western democracies also have guns and gun debates as well. But those gun debates don't exist in the same way in other countries. To find out more about this, let's talk with Mark Berg. He's an associate professor of sociology at the University of Iowa, also director of the Crime and Justice Policy Research Program at the UI's Public Policy Center. And he joins me in our Iowa City studio. Mark Berg, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So I understand you've written about how the U.S. compares with other countries in this context, in the context of violent patterns. What specifically have you looked at?
Yes. So one question that I addressed a few years ago and more recently with colleagues at Penn State University is the question of exactly how the rate of homicide and the nature of homicide differs in the U.S. compared to other advanced capitalist, advanced democratic nations. And what we find and what the evidence has shown is that the U.S., when we compare our rates of homicide or our rates of violence in general, I should say, the U.S. is not necessarily less violent than other countries, much like our own. However, the U.S. does experience a significantly higher rate of gun homicides relative to other nations. So it's not necessarily that the U.S. is more violent. It's that the U.S. experiences higher rates of deadly violence.
Okay, so violence as such is big umbrella term, just to make sure I get that straight, this big umbrella, violence done from one person to another, a group of people to another people, that is in the U.S. comparable to other countries, but when it's done with guns, that's where we are top of the heap.
Yes, significantly so. So, for instance, if we compare rates of unarmed assault or assault, and we compare our rates, for instance, to the United Kingdom, Germany, other European nations, in fact, we experience lower rates in some years on average relative to those nations. Mm-hmm. But when we draw the comparison between rates of gun homicide, we not only exceed others, but we far exceed those other nations that are much like our own. And the U.S. firearm homicide rate, for instance, in the U.S. in 2014 was 7 times higher than Canada's rate, our nearest neighbor to the north. The firearm homicide rate in the U.S. was 600 times higher than the firearm homicide rate in South Korea, which has incredibly low rates of firearm homicide each year. Mm-hmm. So the American homicide problem is, in many ways, an American gun homicide problem. Approximately 70 to 80% of homicides each year in the U.S. are committed with a firearm. In 2014 alone, about 8,124 people died as a result of gun violence. Mm-hmm. Of the approximately 14,000 homicides that were committed that year. In the U.S., the death rate by homicide is approximately 31 people for every million in the population, whereas in countries such as Poland and England, that rate is approximately one person out of every million who dies as a result of gunfire.
Mm-hmm. So is it too simple to say, Mark, people in all the world's countries have violent tendencies, get angry, have disputes, want to take it out on someone else, see someone else responsible and get very upset about it? It's just that we have deadlier weapons and we act on that, whereas someone else might punch someone, knife someone, we more often shoot someone.
Yes, it's certainly true that our population does not differ from populations in any other nation in the world, and that we develop grievances with other people. We often, in some cases, act on those grievances. In some cases, we use some form of self-help. And that form of self-help may involve physically attacking someone. And when a weapon is present, the research shows that the weapon is more likely to facilitate a gun, in particular, a lethal outcome. Mm-hmm. So in our country, one can think of it this way. We have an abundance of tools that increase the probability of deadly outcomes relative to other nations in disputes.
When we talk, when you mention Japan or South Korea, some other countries that are not as similar to us in sort of background, cultural background as well. But when you mention, you know, Canada having a significantly lower homicide rate, how do we explain that? Is that purely explained through laws, or is there something different about their culture? What can you find out there?
Well, their non-gun homicide rate, well, their total homicide rate, is comparable to our non-gun homicide rate. So the differences between our two nations in the homicide rate, largely a function of firearms. But we do, nonetheless, have a high homicide rate relative to other nations, much like our own. And there are arguments and perspectives that some criminologists have proposed that point to the configuration of our institutions in our country and how that may differ from the configuration of institutions in other country that do two things. Under some conditions, these institutions can actually constrain our impulses to act on our own self-interest. That is, they socialize us effectively. And in other cases, these institutions can motivate us to pursue our own goals at the expense of others. Mm-hmm. And when these two institutions are out of balance, the restraints and those institutions that motivate us to pursue our self-interest, it can lead to a variety of maladaptive, antisocial outcomes, in this case, in our country, potentially higher rates of violence.
Mm-hmm. And what we've always known about the country and what the U.S. is known for is this stark individualism when
Absolutely.
Compared to Western European countries or even Canada.
Yes.
Okay.
Correct. In the configuration of our lineal and familial ties differs from other nations, the extent to which we yield to authority and so forth. But there are a number of explanations that often point to the unique qualities of American culture that actually bring about incredible amounts of innovation and rewards for our own nation and for the world more broadly, but they also might contain a dark side, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. One central question, Mark, we've been asking all this week as we focus on gun and guns and gun culture in our series. I've asked it of several guests. Do more guns in a society mean a safer or a less safe society? Now, we've had gun rights advocates, of course. You can hear them say, yes, I want to be able to defend myself. That makes me safer. That makes me able to protect my family. Others say, no, are you crazy? More guns means a less safe society. Well, what is your look, your view on this say about that?
Well, I can say at the outset that this is obviously a very, not only a very controversial topic for a researcher to pursue, but it is also a topic that's laden with methodological problems. But just for a moment, if we assume that there's some evidence that some of us or that a broad swath of researchers tend to agree on, when we peer into that evidence seems to suggest that on average, over time, when we use what we call panel models to examine this, in locales, whether cities, counties, or states, where there are a higher number of guns, a larger private collection, this tends to be associated with a higher level of homicide, but in particular, gun homicide. Now, the question of whether or not guns are positively associated with rates of other forms of crime and less serious violence is open for debate. In fact, the evidence is inconclusive in that regard. But I think there is a general consensus among researchers at this point in 2017 that a larger stock of firearms in private collection is associated on average with a higher rate of homicide and gun homicide in a locale.
Have you looked into more or less restrictive legislation in terms of accessing handguns, if that makes if in any way that can improve it as a less safe or more safe society?
I haven't myself, and I'm not that familiar with some of the more recent research in that genre, but I know that is an active area of research pursued by people both in economics and in criminology.
Mm-hmm. Mark Berg, thank you very much. Director of Crime and Justice Policy Research Program at the UI Public Policy Center, also Associate Professor of Sociology at the UI. Mark Berg, thanks for stepping into our studio.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Finally today, as we finish our week-long series focusing on guns and gun culture here on River to River, how is the gun debate presented in our media? We are part of the media, of course, here at Iowa Public Radio. Are the things in the media we could be doing better? Joining us to discuss These and other questions, Al Tompkins is with us, Poynter Institute's Senior Faculty for Broadcasting and Online. The Poynter Institute for Media Studies is a nonprofit school for journalism. It's located in St. Petersburg, Florida. Al Tompkins, welcome to our program.
Hi, Ben.
Hi. You're also the author of the book Aim for the Heart, A Guide for TV Producers and Reporters.
It's not a gun book, by the way.
Right.
No, the word aim.
You jumped right in there because I wanted to say, well, that's a title for our theme today, but it's actually just a title. You deal with many other things than journalism and guns as well. It's used by many university journalism instructors around the country. That's why we're talking with you, Al. Let me ask you broadly. Generally speaking, how is the gun debate presented in our news media? How are we covering it?
Well, not too well. In the newest edition of the book that I hope journalism schools will continue to use, I actually this time put a whole chapter in about covering guns and ammo. Now, what you got to know about me is that as a journalist, I grew up in Kentucky. I grew up in a hunting culture, so I grew up around guns. I have owned guns. Own a gun now. I'm not an avid hunter, but I grew up in a hunting family. So I know a lot about guns because I grew up around them and, surrounded myself with people who love guns and love hunting and all that kind of stuff. So for me, it was a natural extension as a journalist to know more about guns. And what I found, particularly as I started working into larger and larger markets, which tend to be urban areas, I found that journalists knew very little about guns. They would often misreport guns. They would get calibers mixed up. They'd get automatic mixed up with semi-automatic and so on. And as a journalist, it's not that I'm pro-gun or anti-gun. I'm pro-accuracy. And I just wanted to get it right because I guarantee you, Ben, that if you said something wrong, or I said something wrong on the air today, there are going to be a lot of your listeners who know that's wrong.
Right.
Because they're gun people. They grow up around them. So
right, right.
And the difference between a 20-gauge and a 12-gauge.
Right. And if you get that wrong, they might not necessarily complain to Iowa Public Radio in this case, but they would more or less discredit the rest of the conversation because,
no doubt,
because you, they're saying, well, you don't know what you're talking about, obviously.
No doubt. Listen, I heard a lieutenant governor in Virginia the other day talking about the white nationalists carrying automatic weapons. No, they weren't. No, they weren't. They were carrying semi-automatic weapons. And so the first thing that happens is whenever you hear somebody talking about something that they don't know anything about, you just discount everything else they say.
Right.
You just got it wrong.
Right. And the difference here, to remind us, semi-automatic, one click of the trigger means one bullet. Automatic means you hold that trigger and it just continues.
That's right. Now, look, it always pretty quickly veers into the, well, you can always modify a semi-automatic dog. Look, that's not easy to do, and hardly anybody does it. It's extraordinarily rare and all that. There are people who can do what's called bump firing, where they actually take a semi-automatic rifle, like an AR-15, and they're so skilled at it, they can make it fire as rapidly as an automatic weapon. If you know what you're doing, you can fire pretty rapidly. There's no doubt. And a lot of people, for example, don't know the difference between semi-automatic and what they call a machine gun. And they think machine guns somehow are illegal, but they're not. After the St. Valentine's Day massacre, for example, we started regulating machine guns, automatic weapons, in a very, very strict way. I've told audiences many times before, I've been a journalist now for 43 years, I have never covered a crime that used a legally registered automatic weapon. Never, despite what you see in the movies and all that stuff where they use MAC-10s or something, automatic weapon. I've never covered a crime that used a legally registered automatic weapon.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about this term, since journalism is all about terminology, and we talk about guns, getting it right here. Earlier this week, I talked with a gun industry lobbyist, and he did not like the use of the term assault rifle.
Well, the reason that the word assault rifle is important is because it has been used in legislation. Legislation in the past, assault weapons, what we think of as an AR-15 generally is the most common. And assault weapons generally are characterized by these characteristics. Now, again, this was part of the assault weapon ban, which later expired, was not renewed. And so for a while, the assault weapons under the Clinton administration, the assault weapons were actually made illegal in the United States, and then that ban expired. But the ban included definitions, and some states and cities include definitions. They include some of these. One, a bayonet mount. Now, look, I don't know anybody that has a bayonet on their assault weapon, but it's kind of like putting chrome on your Camaro, you know, it's kind of interesting looking. There's a foldable stock or a collapsing stock. One reason you might do that is to fit you better, particularly people who aren't very tall, or women very often will use collapsible stocks in order to make it more comfortable. The ability to use extended magazines. So high-capacity magazines, or the ability to take a high-capacity magazine, something over 9 rounds, is another one. A flash suppressor is one. It's just something you stick on the end of the barrel.
Right.
And what that would do is make it harder to see, you know, the rifle that you shot.
And
you wouldn't see the flash.
Right. Suppressor is the word you use, will be insisted upon by gun rights advocates, whereas silencers are sometimes
Yeah. Yeah, that's different. Now, a silencer or suppressor, this is a flash suppressor. This it doesn't allow you to see the flash, the basically fiery flash.
Does nothing for the sound, though.
Sound suppressors are different, and this is one of the most interesting things going on right now, is there's a lot of conversation about being making it easier to be able to sell and use sound suppressors. And some people say, oh, my goodness, you know, you're going to start using silencers. Well, they're not silencers. Suppressors aren't silencers. And pro-gunners very wisely are going to state legislators, and they're calling it the Hearing Preservation Act. And what they're saying is, look, if we use these gun suppressors, it will save the hearing of hunters. And so they're using the whole sound suppressor thing as a hearing issue.
So what I'm hearing in your voice, is it a ruse?
I don't know. It's new. I've not seen any data around it. I just don't know. What I do know is anytime my son and I shoot, my daughter and I shoot, you know, we have hearing protection.
Yeah.
So,
sure.
So the answer is I don't know,
yeah.
But I think it's ingenious.
Right. It certainly.
The gunners are calling it a hearing issue.
We had a big overhaul of gun laws here in Iowa the last legislative session, just coming into effect now, and that was certainly presented when the issue of suppressors was brought up here. We've got about 5 minutes left for those who've just joined us. Al Tompkins is with us of the Poynter Institute. It's a nonprofit school for journalism located in Florida. Let's talk about training the journalists. You've helped train thousands of new reporters and producers in your workshops. What are the major points that we haven't talked about, perhaps, that you want to make when you teach journalists about covering guns and gun control, and perhaps some pointers out there for those consuming the media made by these reporters and producers?
It's not unusual for me to encounter journalists who just don't like guns. I mean, they just don't like them. They don't want to be around them. They hate them. They wish they would all go away. And look, they're not alone. There are plenty of people who would say that. Well, what I would say is that you have to accept that there is a culture of guns in the United States. And by the way, the Supreme Court has never wavered off of the idea that you have a right to own guns. It goes all the way back to Plessy versus Ferguson, which we often think of as a civil rights ruling, but it actually has to do with the fundamental rights of what it means to be a citizen of the United States. So it had to do with owning land and owning a mule and owning a gun. They actually mentioned it, Plessy versus Ferguson. But in numerous other court decisions up and down the legal spectrum, the right to own a gun is fundamental. The right to own a gun to defend your home is fundamental. And that's never really been a serious question. So you almost have to take that off the table to say, okay, look, it's clear, based on a couple hundred years' worth of rulings, that you have a right to own a gun to defend your home. So what? Well, remember that no constitutional right is total. That it's not. You don't have a constitutional right to speak, to say whatever you want unless you're held responsible for it, right? So if I defame somebody or libel somebody.
Or yell fire in a theater, I can't do that.
Right. So there are always restrictions, even on constitutional rights. And so the courts have always said there can be reasonable restrictions. You can't own a bazooka. You can't own, you know, there are grenade launchers. I mean, there are all sorts of things you can't do because the courts have said that's a reasonable restriction. So in some places, semi-automatic weapons, for example.
Right. We've got about a minute left. I wish we could talk all afternoon, but go ahead.
So what I would say is the main thing I want them to know what you're talking about, and don't just focus on the nuts, because there's nuts on all sides, right? There are abolitionists, and there are people who say, you know, I'm going to have a gun in my hand and walk down the street and do whatever I want. Don't just go on the extremes. Responsible gun owners are all around us. I guarantee you they're in your audience right now. Careful, thoughtful people who lock up their guns and do safe things and aren't nuts and aren't out killing people. Don't just focus on the extremes. And that's just key for us as journalists, that we look for the real examples.
Al Tompkins, thank you much for joining us with the Poynter Institute.
Thank you for doing this. It's just a great service that you guys are doing here.
Thank you, Al, author of the book, and this title is coincidental. He does deal with guns and gun control and how to cover it in it, but the title is coincidental, as we mentioned at the beginning. Aim for the Heart, a guide for TV producers and reporters. Al Tompkins of the Poynter Institute. Thanks again, Al.
You bet.
River to River is concluding its series on guns and gun culture. Let us know what you think of the program by dropping us your feedback. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Of course, the previous programs this week you may have missed. You can go to our website, iowapublicradio.org, to listen to the podcasts. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.